so that they perfectly cancel, giving you a sharp image of this of the nighttime sky.
Beautiful.
And it was very cleverly done, and only when that became declassified did the world's astronomers say, whoa, we wanted this all along. And so, in fact, many astronomers have been trying to do it, but weren't bankrolled on the level that the military was.
Galaxy itself contains 100 billion stars. It's 100,000 light years side from side. It bulges in the middle, 16,000 light years thick, but out by us, just 3,000 light years wide. We're 30,000 light years from galactic central point. We go round every 200 million years, and our galaxy is only one of millions and billions. This amazing and expanding universe. Now the universe itself keeps on expanding and expanding in every direction it can whisk. As fast as it can go, the speed of light you know, 12 million miles.
This Friday, October 3rd, is week 2 of WBAI's Feminist Film Festival, an evening of film and performance on reproductive justice and freedom. We'll show Lori Harris with a vengeance, covering a wide slice of movement history, from early activism to clashes with the right and women of color challenging mainstream feminism. Then, Jennifer Baumgardner's I Had an Abortion. Women of different ages and ethnic groups face the camera and tell their stories. Lastly, live theater. A stage and TV actor, Stacey Lanance, enacts The Siege, a powerful story of the harassment of a doctor by the far right. For the full 5-week festival schedule, go to WBAI.org. It's all at 388 Atlantic Avenue. Doors open at 6 p.m. for shorts with features at 7:30. The popcorn machine is working. The popcorn is hot. And so is the subject.
Ladies and gentlemen, what's going on? This is Clipper Man, comedian extraordinaire. Thank you for tuning in to WBAI 995 FM, New York, New York. Two Raw for Radio comedy experience every first Monday, y'all. Reception starts at 6:30 p.m. Comedy show starts at 8 p.m. sharp. Tickets and info, www.wbai.org. Every first Monday of the month, ladies and gentlemen. Two Raw for Radio comedy experience, 388 Atlantic Avenue, Brooklyn, New York. Free speech radio.
Good morning. This is Hour of the Wolf, a weekly program dedicated to science fiction, fantasy, enchantment, and the imagination. My name is Jim Freund. This week is part 2 of a conversation started last week with Dan Persons. And once again, Veronica Sheamus will not be here, only we didn't expect her to be here. but we're going to just stay tuned. It's going to be true. I'm Dan Persons, movie reviewer for Hour of the Wolf. I get criticized for continually coming up with theories as to how a movie got made with no shred of evidence that what I'm asserting actually happened. That's a fair cop. They're my own lame brain ideas. I don't pretend they're anything else. I share them anyway because it's a way I analyze a film. It's a way I can look at the elements presented and see where they succeed and where they fail. For instance, I wouldn't be surprised to find out that in the development of the new stop-motion animated film, The Box Trolls, there existed a script in which the main protagonist wasn't Eggs, a young boy kidnapped by the titular box-wearing trolls in infancy and raised in their cozy, grotty, subterranean community, but Winnie, the pampered town girl with an odd obsession about the trolls' alleged deprivations that oscillates between horror and rapt longing. That she would be the star makes some sense. The Box Trolls is produced by Laika, the Oregon animation studio whose previous films, Coraline and Paranorman, featured main characters who took in stride the spooky and occasionally grisly aspects of the worlds they inhabited. If such was the case, it's likely that someone looked over the script, said, "Nah, too Coraline," and engineered a shift of the narrative over to the appealing and stalwart, if somewhat confused by topsider behavior, Eggs. Such a switch would have kept the studio from looking like it was repeating itself. The problem is that you can feel that the creators' hearts are actually with Winnie, the slightly dotty girl who revels in the darker aspects of life, than with the boy who views wearing boxes and scavenging through garbage cans at night as normal. It makes for a film that feels somewhat unsettled. Doesn't help that the very slight storyline is a page straight out of the kids' film playbook. The folk of the town of Cheesebridge live in fear of the trolls' nighttime foragings. Their terror is stoked by the local troll catcher, Archibald Snatcher, voiced by Ben Kingsley, who's using the panic to orchestrate his own rise up the ladder of the town's cheese-based economy. Little do any of the topsiders know that the trolls are peaceful, inventive, and harmless, using the fruits of their rummagings to furnish their underground village, and that the trolls' abduction of the infant Eggs, now grown to adolescence and voiced very well by newcomer Isaac Hempstead Wright, was not an abduction at all. After the troll population is decimated following Snatcher's decade-long extermination campaign, Eggs has to join forces with Winnie, voiced by Elle Fanning, to end the horrific crusade and discover the true secret behind Snatcher's plan, which actually isn't all that different from the plan everybody knows about anyway. There's the usual stuff about understanding our differences and some fooling around with the idea of pushing past one's perceived nature. But since the bad guy is also trying to push past his nature in his own way, that gets a bit muddied.
Actually, what themes there are here seem to be there just because they need to be, not because the story has any new way to explore them. At least we're not being told it's all about family or friendship, at least not overtly. What there is, of course, is the fantastic Laika stop-motion animation, exquisitely choreographed miniature actors playing through exquisitely detailed miniature sets. Each character's unique personality is expressed through their movement, all the way down to how the box trolls use their cardboard garments to execute cooperative maneuvers. And if the story overall is a dud, there are tons of wonderful set pieces within, including Egg's attempt to mix in with a bunch of partygoers, and a dining sequence in which Snatcher's cheese allergy manifests itself in horrific ways as the character, deep in denial, plays through a pretense of gentility. It's too bad that the whole is less than the sum of its parts, but it's those parts that still make the box trolls something worth seeing. I'm Dan Persons. Remember, we are archiving these reviews over at MightyMoviePodcast.com. And if you love science fiction, fantasy, and horror film, please check out CineFantastique Online at CFQOnline.com.
And I did mention before that given that this is sort of a comeback program, 2 weeks in a row, and being that it's October, it makes this a double feature. It was going to be Celluloid Heroes or this.
Michael Rennie was ill the day the earth stood still, but he told us.
And I really should have run the Roxy version rather than
Flash Gordon. Was there,
this is what came
in silver underwear. Claude Rains was the invisible man. Then something went wrong for Fay Wray and King Kong. They got caught in a celluloid jam. Then at a deadly pace, it came from outer space. This is how the message ran.
Well, this looks like not a typical WBAI's internet connection in the control room, basically stalling, because that's what we're doing. We're listening to an internet feed, and it's basically locked up. But you know what? As I said, it's okay. It was the right song. It was the wrong version. There are wronger versions, like the one from Glee. That's a very wrong version.
No. Unhappy McNabb. No.
Yeah, exactly. Why does the Firebird lay its egg? The Roxy version, which is the original recorded version, and with the proper cast, which is to say, Meatloaf, Tim Curry. Unfortunately, no, Susan Sarandon, but she only gets one song, no, two songs over at the Frankenstein Place, which doesn't count anywhere near as much as Touch a Touch a Touch Me, which is not being shown at the WBAI Feminist Film Festival. I can't understand why not. Yeah. But the
Don't dream it, be it.
Yeah. Well, actually, the theme of the movie would fit perfectly well.
Yeah, I would say so. Yeah.
But that specific song, the visuals of it would have...
I saw the show when it played at the Belasco, the beautiful Belasco, as they would say over the PA.
Uh-huh.
At the beginning.
That was the revival?
Yeah. Yeah,
the one
that
actually ran.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, no, I didn't get to see that. I've never seen the show live. I went to more than a few midnight screenings, but I really didn't care for the cultish interactivity. It was fun once or twice, like going to a science fiction convention and carrying on with people. But the second or third time I went, some idiots in like two rows in front at the wedding scene, where it's obligatory to throw rice, threw the rice in people's eyes. They just weren't looking. They just went back, not up, but back. Yeah. And at least three people, including the person I was accompanying, had to leave the theater. Yeah. They were hit in their eyes by more than one piece of rice.
I saw it at all midnight shows. I saw it. I think I saw it twice. Once actually before they started with all this, with all the live interaction.
Which would be pretty early.
Way early.
And that would have been at the Waverly or at the 8th Street Playhouse. Was
it at the 8th Street? It was at the 8th Street Playhouse.
I think it opened there.
No, you know what? I tell a lie. It was actually at the Elgin.
At the Elgin?
Yeah, it may even have been before they started with the actual midnight show.
Elgin was running El Topo that night.
Yeah, that's right. The Elgin was running El Topo, but it was actually before they started with the midnight screenings.
Yeah.
Of Rocky Horror. So it would have been during a regularly scheduled show rather than the midnight show. And then I went back for the 8th Street Playhouse.
Okay.
For one of the screenings. And
I don't remember anymore the entire etymology because I was usually not in a state of sobriety. And no, I wasn't drinking.
You go into the Elgin, you'd get a contact high.
Well, absolutely. That was half the. I loved the Elgin.
The Elgin was
I mean, there were a lot of revival houses in New York. The Rialto showed largely Japanese films and stuff like that, owned by a gentleman named Euster, E-U-S-T-E-R, and his daughter. And there was one on Broadway in the low 70s, the Regency. Then there was the Thalia.
Right, the Thalia, further uptown, 90th.
Still is. I think it's 96.
It's not operating now. Wasn't the Alamo Draft House supposed to go into the Thalia?
I don't even know what the Alamo Draft House is.
You don't know? Good Lord, the Alamo Draft House is started out in Austin, Texas, hence Alamo.
Is this a restaurant?
It's a movie theater chain now. I think they've got one in upstate New York, or maybe it's Brooklyn. I'm not sure. One of those. They've got, I think, a few in Los Angeles. And yes, it is a combination of a screening room, and you can get food and drink while you're watching the film, which doesn't particularly thrill me. But they are,
that's not the experience.
But it's the classic repertory,
and there always was. The classic repertory was the Janus Film Festival, which still does turn up every so often.
Yeah,
although given that for a not totally unreasonable price, you can buy the entire Janis film collection on Blu-ray with so much commentary. I mean, your average film has four different commentary tracks.
Most films these days, they're lucky if they have one commentary track. But
on Blu-ray?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Listen, you know, one of the things I wanted to talk about is I've got here the Blu-ray of Ghost in the
Shell. And we do have a topic, which we'll get to
yeah,
in a while,
we
which
will
be
get
adaptations.
To, yes,
but
right.
Go, okay.
But while we're talking about it, I've got this, and I may as well get it out here. I've got this adaptation of Ghost in the Shell. Have you ever seen Ghost in the Shell?
No interest.
By the way, you should. It's one of the better cyberpunk films.
It's anime.
It's anime, but it's beautifully done. It's done by...
Now, you see, that's an oxymoron.
It should
still
not
pictures
be.
That are moving back and forth like a Javanese puppet show is not animation.
Oh, you haven't seen this. This is done by production.
It's true, I haven't seen it. Nor
this is
I'm the one I've been told that I have to see as an entry level to anime is Millennium Actress.
Millennium Actress is a fantastic film.
Yeah,
as well.
I've been told that, you know, if Jim, says Amy Goldschlager, if there is an anime film you would like, it would probably be that. And I say, I don't know enough Japanese film history. And she said, it
you
doesn't
don't
matter.
Need to. You don't need
That's what
to.
She said.
It's practically a primer in and of itself.
It's in my queue. I will get around to it. In the meantime, I've seen at least two Miyazaki films, and I was not spirited away by any of them. That's unfair. I saw all of Princess Mononoke, and I thought it was monotonous. I really didn't like it at all. I got the message. I saw the pretty artwork, but the animation was so poor that the Astro Boy quality just kept me out
well,
of the film.
We can get into... I mean, there's a difference in the style of Japanese animation, and you mentioned Astro Boy, and yes, it does all stem literally from Astro Boy.
Yes.
They had a low budget. They couldn't do much with it. What they discovered was a way...
But so did Jay Ward, and Jay Ward was watchable.
What the Japanese discovered, and this sort of falls into a connection with the Japanese culture overall, was they found a way of making a virtue of the still images instead of doing elaborate, expensive animation. What they discovered was ways of creating dramatic poses that could be held.
I forget. Did you like Ernest and Celestine or not?
Yes, I did.
Yes, you
very
did.
Much so.
That was made on a lower budget.
Oh, yeah, I'm sure. But the thing is, it doesn't matter much about budget anymore as far as Japanese animation
I'm
is concerned.
I'm talking about any animation.
For one thing, you should see this because the animation is far more elaborate, far more detailed. It's beautiful.
I did like the few episodes I saw of Cowboy Bebop.
Bebop.
I thought there was a lot of cool stuff happening there. But when I was halfway through the third episode, I said, I've seen this twice before.
Did you ever get to Pierrot Le Fou?
No.
You need to see that one.
Okay.
That is a messed up episode.
I'm willing to believe they had them, but what do I have to wade through to get to it?
You don't have to wade through anything. It's a standalone episode.
Oh, okay, so I can just pull it
you
up.
You can just pull it up and watch it.
Oh,
yeah.
Okay.
And I will try that.
And
it is worth it because it'll mess with
your
mind.
I'm not saying all anime sucks. I'm not saying that,
but I am saying that as
a form... It has yet to trans... And now, I watched about the first 15 minutes of Spirited Away, all taking place in the amusement park and all that.
Yeah.
And...
The village. It's actually a village. It's a village of spirits.
But it's got that feel.
Yeah, that's true.
And my partner and I looked at each other and said, you know, we could watch something we'd enjoy instead.
Well, then you're a hopeless case. That's all. That's it.
Well, it's let's just say it's an art form I don't appreciate. I'm not saying it's bad.
Yeah.
I'm saying it's an art form I do not appreciate.
It's a different style of animation. It's a different style of storytelling. A lot of it has to do with the...
By the way,
stillness of the image.
Tomorrow morning at about 7 a.m. on Turner Classic Movies, Prince Ahmed and the Something Era.
The Adventures of Prince Ahmed.
The first
feature animated film.
Yes. It's about 1926.
Something like that, yeah.
And that's mostly stick figures.
Shadow puppets.
Stick figures.
Yeah.
They used two or three techniques.
Yeah.
And it's beautiful.
It's a fantastic
film. It does get a little boring. It's only an hour 15 minutes long, and it should be about, 20 minutes shorter.
I really enjoyed it.
And if you're an animation fan, that's a good one. You know, post-Windsor McKay, but... pre-Disney.
Yeah. Point I wanted to make, Ghost in the Shell thing, and despite what Jim says, I think if you haven't seen this and you are into science fiction, and in particular cyberpunk, you need to see this. It's a fantastic film. It's out of the works of Masamune Shirow, who did a lot... and this is early 90s, about the web and the interconnection, and also the question of what happens when humanity becomes more mechanized, what happens when humanity begins to interface more and more with the web, and what happens to us as humans. Mm-hmm. And Ghost in the Shell follows along with those themes and throws in some stuff that the director Mamoru Oshii also obsesses on himself.
I've heard of Oshii.
Yeah.
But having said that,
yes. Those
very plot points
were
dealt with in the 40s.
I'm sure they were.
And they didn't have the web per se.
But they are still
Jack
evergreen.
Williamson and Frederick Pohl.
One of my own personal obsessions as far as storytelling is concerned is exploring the issue of what makes us human.
Yeah.
How do we know when we're human? How do we know when someone else is human? And so things like John Carpenter's The Thing, those type of story.
Which would be a great film. We've had this argument before.
If it wasn't for the screeching,
25 seconds of the movie.
Okay.
One word. Ankles.
Let me get to the point, because we had been talking about commentary tracks. I just got this. It's the 25th anniversary edition. It's finally out on Blu-ray. It's beautifully done. This is supposed to be, as I say, 25th anniversary. There are no features on this at all.
That's a ripoff.
And the DVD, I also have the DVD version. It has a 1 hour, I think it's a 1 hour. At the very least, it's got a featurette on the making of the film. That's very good. They don't even have that.
That's a very good reason for boycotting the company. Who put that out?
This is great. I'm going to tell the company, and then we're going to tell people not to buy it.
I'll take full responsibility.
Okay, fair enough. You take it on your shoulders.
If a publisher puts out a book with pages that fall out, and yet you like the book, would you recommend that people buy that book?
Fair enough. It's coming out from Anchor Bay, and
they really could have
just lifted the material from the DVD.
They could have gotten Joel Hodgson and two other guys to sit there.
No,
and
not
make
for Ghost in the Shell. You need to watch this.
Oh, okay, fine. But the point is that you have a choice.
Yeah.
And about 2 years ago, I got a Monty Python and the Holy Grail that has on one audio track Terry Jones and Terry Gilliam, on another one Eric Idle, Michael Palin, and John Cleese. There are about 4 hours of documentary material on the making of it, plus sing-along stuff, plus useless internet connectivity things built in, all for under $20. Mm-hmm. And yes, they converted the screen very nicely.
Yeah.
Did a very nice job in the conversion. So,
I don't know what's happening here. And
if you buy any movie, don't care whether you like the movie or not, from Criterion, mm-hmm. you're going to get your money's worth.
Yeah.
Because they put love into not just the mastering of the film, but into why are we putting this, 40-year-old film on Blu-ray? They can't improve the pixel count.
Well, on Blu-ray, in theory,
they can up
up the resolution, but
they can up the resolution and all that.
Yeah.
And Third Man on with great cinematography, mm-hmm. upward conversion and all that looks nice, but the point is that they spent not tons of money to get film critics and a couple of mm-hmm. other people into the room, throw on the trailer. Least you can do is put in the trailer and a few language and subtitle options, and with something as cultish as Ghost in the Shell, mm-hmm. which I think comes in number two to Akira.
Yes.
Is that about right?
Yeah, that's pretty much it. Let me just throw in Akira got me interested. Ghost in the Shell set the hook for me as far as anime was concerned.
Fair enough. I can go to any science fiction convention and walk out with three people worthy of doing a commentary track.
By the way, I probably
wouldn't have to go to more than two rooms at that convention in order to get those people qualified to do it.
By the way, Anchor Bay, I am available.
Okay.
I may as well. That's
exactly the point.
Yeah.
That's exactly the point. It costs them next to nothing.
He's right, Anchor Bay.
It costs them next to nothing, and it helps justify the price of Blu-ray, which is generally not cheap.
Yeah. I engaged in a bit of hyperbole when I said, they're reducing down. There are a number of releases coming out where they do give you the wealth of stuff.
There are a lot of companies that do it.
Yeah.
And that's why I'm saying that if somebody's putting out a Blu-ray disc, I mean, right now they're trying to figure out how are they going to put the DVD extras and stuff like that on streaming companies, mm-hmm. a la Amazon Prime and Netflix and Hulu Plus and the rest of those. They are doing those there. So, folks, and they're coming up, they're already at 1080, and they're pushing that envelope up to higher resolution. So,
going up
Blu-ray
4K.
Yes, there is such a thing as 4K.
Yeah, there is 4K. That's the next step. They have started coming out with 4K monitors.
I've been seeing a number of those, and if you can afford the $12,000.
Exactly.
But
it's going to be a little time.
Only about 5 years.
Yeah, that's time.
Only about
that's
5 years here. Before they're in the $600 range.
Yeah. Yeah.
Or whatever passes for $600 in 5 years, but in that range.
Yeah.
And the point is that the competition for media is getting real. It's very serious. And when you're talking about streaming on demand, availability, the ability of me to take my phone, plug that into a 60-inch 4K monitor and see something in that resolution using my phone and a dongle, and I can do that today and spend less than $100 to be able to do that, not counting the phone. And I can spend under $200 on the phone with no contract. Yeah. The Blu-ray company people had better start realizing that they can go the way of the 8-track if they're not careful.
Some are saying that's already a foregone conclusion. Some are saying that...
Well, it is a foregone conclusion. The question is, how much life do they have?
Yeah.
And I'll tell you this. If they do the quality kind of stuff that's... I don't want to harp on this one thing because I don't want to promote them necessarily, and their boxes are not cheap, but the love and care that Criterion puts into their stuff makes it a collector's item the same way that people collect their vinyl LPs.
Yeah.
That it's, you know, and that will not go away. And guess what? LPs are coming back for their beauty, for their usefulness and flexibility.
Purchased mostly by hipsters, though.
Well, you see, there's a word that I only
I know. Yeah, I sort of have a problem with it, too.
It's a new word coined by people who, it's like, am I a hipster?
Yeah.
I keep my old LPs, yes, because I do like to look at them. I really don't give a dang whether there's a disc inside or not. I'm quite happy to listen to it through a streaming service, which, as long as you're not a WBAI, works fine. because we were using legal, I should mention, streaming service, one that I pay a monthly fee for in order to play the music that I play on the show. It's why would I buy a CD today? If a new album comes out, I can listen to it at home on the day of release without buying the album. I pay a monthly fee.
Yeah.
And I get that. And that's only... There are two new companies, big companies, coming out with new streaming services before Christmas. So one is Google and the other can't be mentioned yet.
Mm-hmm.
And Apple has been trying to put something together, and eventually maybe they will do it, but so far they've totally failed.
Well, they've just closed down their music service.
Yeah, well, they bought a music service, and they closed it down.
Yeah, duh.
Where Google now has three music services, and they're starting a new one. They have Google Play, which is the one that I use. I won't call YouTube a streaming service, but people use it that way. And they have Songza, which is more of a method of streaming rather than a library, because it's a curated kind of a thing.
Google is something of a cluster bleep anyway, in terms of service. As far as television is concerned, you've got Google TV, you got Chromecast.
Well, Google TV has never gone
anywhere. Yeah, it's never gone anywhere.
Chromecast is not content, it's hardware.
It's hard, but it's...
$35 hardware.
Yeah, it's $35 hardware, but it's a way of getting the content on there. But it also essentially... It essentially usurps the function of Google TV.
No, Google TV was a totally different interface and a totally different way of recording, like a la DVR, but keeping it in the cloud.
Well, it wasn't even about recording. Google TV was actually supposed to be unifying all the video onto one device so that you could do the search and get the video up there.
But you could also, a la TiVo, just say, I want all movies with Cary Grant available to me now.
Yeah.
And so that that was about the content.
Yeah. It was about unifying the content.
You would key in Cary Grant into the Google thing,
and you'd get here's what's on Amazon, here's what's available on Netflix.
That was one thing, but the other thing was you can say, fine, I have these, show it to me now.
Yeah.
And actually, somebody who's starting to do that is Roku.
Mm-hmm.
Although it's not out yet. I saw it on Monday, though.
Ah.
And what Roku has is something that does, in fact, take everything down to and including your over-the-air antenna TV and just makes that a channel. on your Roku box. It's more successful than Google TV in that sense. Apple TV is useless. I love my Roku box, and I have an older one.
Yeah.
And there are any number of competitors to that.
I've got so many boxes now duplicating functions.
But Chromecast has no content.
Mm-hmm. Chromecast is just a device.
Way. Yeah. It's a stream. Yeah. It streams from your other devices.
Right. Right. That's true. That is true. It strikes me that Google sort of goes, well, let's try this. Well, that's not working. Let's bleep can that. And here's the other. Here's the next thing.
Well, take a product that works. Unfortunately, in the case of one, they created Buzz. Buzz was actually fairly decent, but it had such a bad rep that they had to kill it quickly.
I never heard of Buzz.
That's exactly my point.
Yeah.
Buzz was in its way better than Google Plus. Google Plus is excellent, but it's a ghost town, except for tech journalists. Tech journalists and a certain amount of science fiction people are there. Mm-hmm. And if you want to find where the tech people are, you go to Google Plus, not Facebook, in order to ask a question, find out where people are talking about technology, science, what's going on in space, NASA, all that stuff. You're going to find that on Google Plus more so than Facebook. And what you can do and the things you can build are fabulous on there, but nobody home.
Yeah.
Nobody's using it, and so there's no point to it. And Google has made the big mistake of trying to use Google Plus to unify all the Google products. They're now starting to move away from that. The powers that be. But the way I see it is Google had two eras, the Eric Schmidt era and the Larry Page era. We are now, Larry Page is the founder of Google, but he never ran it. They brought in Eric Schmidt, who was on the board of Apple and Disney, and Rand Novell, and he is at Sun, and a mastermind at things, and he's the guy who innovated Google into being this thing where anybody could spend 20% of their time, paid time, working on any project they wanted, and you had Google Health, and you had Google Notebook, you had all these wonderful products that they've gotten rid of. And then they decided that their biggest competitor was Facebook. And so they went horn to horn with Facebook, and duh, it's not going to work. And Google has gone into some, they're still not being evil, but they've really turned a corner in which they're not being as good as they were either.
Mm, yeah.
But that's my tech talk thing.
Yeah.
And for people who don't know, tech talk is a way that I made a living for, 20 years. So writing for Ziff Davis magazines, running their online services, and working with people like Tim Berners-Lee, the man who invented the web.
It's another kind of nerdgasm.
I was Irish there before. Well, I met my partner.
Well, let me tell you about the VIC-20, buddy.
No, I was there before that.
I'm sure.
I was online with Atari 800 in 1981. And I came late. By 1981, so many people were already had been online since about 1978.
Yeah.
On what was the name of that tax company? The number one tax preparation.
H&R Block, not H&R.
Was it Block who owned them? No, it was. Maybe it was Block, but anyhow, CompuServe.
CompuServe
was
owned
by an insurance company. Absolutely, absolutely. It was a way. It was a way to file your returns. Mm-hmm. And then there was the Source from Reader's Digest. And then there was Prodigy, that was a combination of Sears, CBS, and a third company. I don't recall the third. Mm-hmm. I worked with CompuServe and Prodigy. I was a WizOp on CompuServe, and I oversaw a WBAI radio personality on Prodigy, who actually ran it on his own.
I did more CompuServe than I did Prodigy. I know I was on Prodigy. And then of course, America Online came along.
And there was Genie.
Genie.
General Electric.
Yes.
Free account to anybody who's a member of Science Fiction Writers of America.
Yeah, and I did. I did.
And we offered that at CompuServe as well.
Yeah.
But nobody ever took me up on it.
Mm.
Yes, I was the responsible for that, although I was working for Ziff. Anyway, we're really off topic.
We're way off topic. Can I mention one other thing before we get into adaptations? Because
besides Ghost in the Shell,
a horror movie. I went to the press screening last night. This is actually not opening for another couple of months. It's opening November 1st. Not November. It's opening November 28th.
That is a couple of months.
So it's weird. It's opening for some reason for the Christmas season. I'm not sure why. It's an Australian film. It's called The Babadook.
Mm-hmm.
And it is possibly the best horror film I've seen in the last few years. It is absolutely incredible. The story is sort of what you would sort of expect. It's about a single mother and her son. Her husband died driving her to the hospital to have the kid. So she's got that weight bearing down on her. And the son is clinging. The son is now 6 years old. He's clinging and a little fearful. And this is before he finds a mysterious and very ominous pop-up storybook called Mr. Babadook, about a fun little visitor who turns out to be not so fun by the end of the book.
Mm-hmm.
And once that gets to the kid's head, the kid goes way off the scale in terms of how he relates to other people. He is terrified of Mr. Babadook, and he is trying to protect his mother from her. And I'll stop describing it there. What I can say is that once the storybook...
Good premise.
It's a good premise. Once the storybook gets discovered, it gets exceedingly intense. This is a very intense horror film. One of the things that I think makes it stand out is that the director is a woman, Jennifer Kent, and she brings, and I sort of hate to use this term, but she does bring a sort of woman's sensibility to the scenario. So
she brings a woman's point of view.
A woman's point of view, and it does relate a lot. It isn't just one form of horror that you're getting here. There's a supernatural kind of horror. There's a psychological kind of horror that's in it. It is about sort of the pressures of confronting your own guilt. It's about being a parent. It's about learning to forgive. It is a really intense and fantastic film, and you know,
now you know the question I've got.
Okay,
three words.
Is it splooshy?
Yeah.
It's not.
I'm not going to go see The Equalizer, and it's too bad because I like the TV series.
You may have.
I like Denzel Washington.
You may have problems with it. I would say.
Oh, Tony Scott of the New York Times had problems with it.
With the Babadook or?
No, I'm talking about.
No.
I'm talking about The Equalizer, which is not a science fiction film.
Okay,
it's a family TV show, starring Edward Woodward.
Right. Right.
It was not a great, but it was a good, fun, you know, 70s / 80s.
No, it was very well reviewed show. I know that. I never actually watched the show, so I don't know. But
retired CIA agent finds people who have nowhere else to turn to, can take out a classified ad, and you basically get an expert agent for your otherwise and that is the premise of the movie as well. But the movie is exceedingly gory.
Okay, let me say this isn't all that gory. There is one sequence with black bile that's about as explicit as it gets. I don't want to go into details.
That's not too
bad. It's not explicitly gory. It is violent. It does get
I don't have problems.
You don't have problems
with violence.
I would suggest you hire yourself to go and see this.
Okay, you know, it's not violence.
Yeah.
That if yeah. I couldn't take violence, I couldn't watch Guardians of the Galaxy, which may have the highest body count of a film, any film I've ever seen, except for Dr. Strangelove.
It's very intense violence. I will say that. It's very intense violence, but the intensity is more psychological. The intensity is more in the use of imagery and how imagery
I don't is necessarily
deployed.
Have a problem with it. It might scare the heck out of me, but that's
which
okay.
Which it will.
But that's the point.
Yeah.
Otherwise, it wouldn't be called horror.
Horror film. Exactly.
But so it's I don't dislike horror films.
There's really not a lot of blood and guts.
That's the question.
Yeah.
You know, it's I don't need to see on-screen evisceration.
Yeah.
I don't, if you do something, like for example, before I went on the air, we mentioned the movie in passing, Wolfen, which has a nasty little beheading in it. It's split second and it doesn't make you go, yuck.
Yeah.
Even Scanners.
Scanners
is perfectly
you're
watchable.
You're okay with Scanners? If you're okay with Scanners
is on the borderline for me, but it's also so over the top, it's laughable.
Yeah. If you're okay with Scanners, you'll be okay.
And I'll tell you a movie that you will not believe I was okay with, but I was. I cannot believe I was okay with it. Mm-hmm. I loved From Dusk Till Dawn.
Indeed. Okay.
Now, there is a movie that should be like double X rating for its gore and knifings and stuff, but I was laughing too hard to take notice of it. It was just so funny and so well done. This isn't Freddy Krueger. This isn't the five kids in the log cabin,
right,
whether they're overseen by Joss Whedon or not.
By the way, this is not a body count film. It's not that kind of film. It does take certain elements, certain expected elements of the genre, but it is a completely different sensibility. It's a different point of view, and that's what
makes it. But, for example, this film that you love that sounds like I would like, except for the gore, from the Korean director, the one on the train.
Snowpiercer.
Snowpiercer. There sounds like an innovative, brilliant science fiction film. Mm-hmm. I saw another film of his. Not
The Host.
Boy.
The Host.
No, I did not see The Host.
No.
This is a comedy about, maybe it's a different director, but I don't think so. It's a youngish, late teens, early 20s, boy and a girl in a mental hospital who have these things happening to them, but a lot of it is simply imagery. We're never sure whether they're captive or not. We don't even know whether or not they're in a hospital. Mm-hmm. There's one scene where in the middle of the movie, the two of them hold hands and fly over the Swiss Alps yodeling.
Okay, that one I didn't see.
I channeled flipping. I saw this thing. I could not turn it off. It was brilliant. It was genius. And I think it may be that same director. Unfortunately, so many of them have vaguely similar names.
Yeah.
And usually include the name Park.
Yes.
Oh, which reminds me, I have to promote my next reading with Paul Park and Jim Morrow. But anyway.
What I wanted to do was to get that out because I had seen it. This was my opportunity, and I tend, when I'm doing my reviews, to forget to insert, like, the little things. Oh, by the way, this is opening this week. You should go and see this as well. So I wanted to get it out, and also because what happens with me is when I see a film like this, and it's rare that I get this way with a horror film. I come out of a horror film, and I am completely exhilarated by it. The last time it may have happened really seriously was with Carrie, where I came out, and I guess it's sort of, the catharsis of it, that you get taken through that trip and you come out.
And we are talking about the film from the by Brian De Palma.
Yeah, the Brian De Palma.
It wasn't the Broadway musical.
Wasn't the recent remake, although I will say this, if it wasn't for the existence of the Brian De Palma film, the recent version of Carrie would have been one of the better Stephen King adaptations.
Except that had you not have heard of the Brian De Palma film, you would not have heard of Stephen King.
That's, well...
Unless you're a particular kind of a reader.
Yeah.
But that's what turned him into
a superstar. Yes.
Okay.
Yeah,
otherwise, he would be another good genre writer.
Yeah. Yeah. That's
true. And by now, may have switched to writing more science fiction, which he's very good at. Would you open that door?
Why, there? I think I shall.
And as you let Lister in... I just wanted to repeat the point. Close that door quickly. That noise from those people next door. You know, neighbors, I got to tell you, neighbors, they're awful.
Anyway, makes me want to dance.
Not me. makes me want to add soundproofing. but just to repeat a point I've made on this argument many times, and then we'll get off of it.
Okay.
There are a lot of great horror films and tension films that have no blood, no gore.
Oh, of course.
They may
of
have
course.
Deaths in... I mean, one of the best suspense movies ever made. Suspense, not horror. Well, the theater version was better.
Mm-hmm.
And I saw it on Broadway with Lee Remick and Robert Duvall. Mm-hmm. Wait Until Dark.
It's a very good film.
And the movie... seen under the right circumstances, which is to say, turn off the lights, at least for the last 40 minutes.
Yeah.
That's one of the most frightening films ever made.
It was very good.
And there are three deaths. Well, Susie's killed off screen and in the play before the play opens. I saw that on Broadway twice. I saw the original with Lee Remick and Robert Duvall, and I saw a revival with Marissa Tomei, who was much better than anybody would suspect on stage, and you're not going to believe who played Harry Rote.
Let's see here. John Malkovich.
Not a guy who does a lot of theater.
Not a
Malkovich, although he would be a great Harry Rote.
He probably would, now that I think about it.
Yeah, because he can do the malevolence, but he also has to be that effete, nice guy.
He could probably do it.
Quentin Tarantino on Broadway as Harry Rote.
Oh, he'd be good.
He'd
be good.
Not would be.
I've got to talk from the position of not having seen. Yeah.
Well, I did see it. Unfortunately, the adaptation was not good. Unfortunately, they tried to update it, and when you think about it, it really is a period piece.
Yeah.
They moved it from a Greenwich Village underground photographer's studio to a Soho loft with fluorescent lighting. And tried to use the fluorescent lighting as a gotcha and a transition between scenes. And it did not work. But the acting, Tarantino, I was so set to loathe and despise him.
Yeah.
And I came out going, he's brilliant.
Yeah.
He's wonderful.
Oh, that's cool. Was that in New York?
Yeah, that was Broadway.
Wow.
That was on Broadway.
How long ago?
Ugh. Maybe 15 years ago.
Wow.
It was the revival. There's only been the one revival.
Yeah.
What they should do is revive it again and restore it to being a 60s set piece, because now it's a costume drama. when I saw it on Broadway in the late 60s, it was a contemporary work. Even the movie...
Is contemporary.
With Audrey Hepburn and Alan Arkin, especially Alan Arkin in that.
Fantastic,
In an incredible career, that may be his best performance ever. And that's saying a lot.
Yeah.
Because he's had such a career.
Yeah, that's true.
But the point is that you are not going to breathe for a good portion of that play or movie. And there is one point in that movie where you are going to scream out loud. And I don't care who you are, if you're paying attention and if you're following what's going on, blood count, zero.
Mm-hmm.
You could, when in the movie, the Richard Crenna character The one sympathetic character of the Crooks, when he gets killed in the play and the movie, he's knifed from the back. All we know is that all he's saying goodbye, and all of a sudden his eyes go wide, and he falls down the stairs, and there's a knife in his back, and then slowly Harry Rote enters.
Yeah.
Now, the director, I was going to do a production of that show. I was going to do a revival before the other one happened, off Broadway.
Mm-hmm.
And the way, although we had a star involved, and who I can't name, and people don't know I was once involved in the theater, not like David Rothenberg, but I was involved in the theater at one time, and the
you were on the concession stand, didn't you?
Yeah, that's right. And there's a Tony Award with my name on it for Best Play of the Year.
Because you always had the freshest jujubes. I'm yanking your chain.
But I was one of like 40 names.
Yeah, yeah.
Not because I invested, but because I hired a publicist. It's true. It's true. Well. But there you go. And I won't tell much more of the story than that. It's something I don't discuss on the air or online. But it's a long, in private, that's fine.
Yeah, yeah,
but,
okay.
But at
fair
any
enough,
rate, the
enough.
Point is, I've been involved in theater, and the way that the director, who was at the time my business partner, the way she wanted to direct it was with a hand coming around from behind the guy as he's standing there, and a Sweeney Todd-style throat slit. And I don't mean the kind that they have on PBS or even one of the revivals, the nastiest one of which I saw was...
With the PBS? Well, the PBS is the only one I saw.
Okay, so. Well, there have been two on PBS.
Yeah.
There was a Florida reconstruction of the Broadway version,
right,
directed by Hal Prince,
yeah,
with the proper cast, which is Angela Lansbury and the replacement,
right,
Len Carreyrou. The original was George
great.
Hearn.
Who is still great.
I thought Len Carreyrou was a better Sweeney. I think George Hearn sang better.
But
I think Len.
I never saw George Hearn. I thought Len Carreyrou.
I saw it with both.
Yeah.
And I thought Len Carreyrou was far more sinister.
Yeah.
And got that Sweeney thing across. Yeah. Then I saw an off-Broadway production, not 4 or 5 years ago. I can't remember the name of the director, but he does a lot of reinterpretations of Sondheim. In this one, everybody actually carried their own instruments on stage.
Yeah, I remember
and,
that.
Michael, really good actor, bald guy, played Sweeney. Patti LuPone was supposed to play Mrs. Lovett, but I'm very pleased to say she was out sick. When I saw it. And
sort of an odd man.
So it was Judy Cass. I'm going to make a very nasty statement that's worse than my anime statement.
Okay.
Patti LuPone and anybody. Except maybe Mandy Patinkin, because we'll see which one can outhand the other. Are a bad match, okay?
Okay.
I'm just not a LuPone fan.
Mm-hmm.
It's yank her off and put in Bernadette Peters, and I'm happy. And they've done that any number of times in theater. And the critics are always writing, come back, come back! She's out of it! Bernadette's in it now! In that, what they did was they had Sweeney off on one extreme side of the stage and the barber chair on the other extreme side of the stage. And Sweeney just draws in the air, pulling his razor in the air against nothing, just toward the audience. And on the left side of the stage, where the guy sitting in the barber's seat, we see his throat going red. Nobody near him. It's an old stage trick. It's a very old stage trick. Penn and Teller can tell you exactly how to do it.
Sure.
But, I mean, this is Grand Guignol style theater, and oh my God. Now, if you had taken that light and put it to the guy's throat, as they do in the Angela Lansbury version, what they have is the razor blade has a spray.
It has a little, it's got like essentially a water pistol mechanism.
It's a spray paint thing.
Yeah.
I mean, specifically, it's spray paint.
Yeah.
There's a technical name for it, but in essence, it's something that's... You know, a lot of science fiction artists use to make starscapes and stuff. And that's what they use in the Lansbury. Avery Fisher Hall production, which I have not yet seen on television. Mm-hmm. I was in the house. I saw it from very, very expensive seats.
Were you at the taping for it, or was it another?
All six performances taped.
All six, okay.
All six were taped. They did not, in two of them, including the one that I went to, they did not have Audra McDonald with the flimsy excuse that she introduced it on TV. Well, mm-hmm. I saw the introduction. She does a very good 60-second thing, so why should she not play the old woman, Lucy?
Mm-hmm.
And on TV, I saw she was in it.
Yeah.
But the reason that they gave, she was in the audience. She came up and took a bow with Sondheim at the end. So she could have done those performances. So, but what they do is they film, they're doing Showboat next.
Mm-hmm.
They've already done Company. They film about six performances, and then they edit them together. But one of the most bizarre, wonderful things about that production is watching the cameras. They look like bots.
Because they are bots.
But they're not, they are called
robotic cameras.
Are they?
Yes.
Okay. Well, they certainly look it. They look like, you know, one-eyed things out of any number of movies, and they just move around and...
Usually now guided by one person.
There were two people.
Were there two people? Okay.
One was directing the other. I don't know.
Fewer people than there are cameras.
Yes. There were about nine cameras.
Yeah.
And it was just amazing to see these things float. And the wonderful thing about that is you can choose to ignore them unless you're just gasping at the technology, which I was. But I have been to tapings. I went to a Berlioz opera where I saw nothing because the camera person was totally in my way. And I went to a young people's concert when I was a young person with Leonard Bernstein, where the camera wasn't directly in front of me, but still you couldn't watch what was going on stage for the three people that were doing this. These things never got in
the technology
your way.
Has gotten very small and very, very independent now.
Yeah. But if you are a Sondheim fan, I would say that musically, this is the best Sweeney that I have heard or seen staged.
I watched it when it was on PBS this past week.
Last Friday.
And it's a stunning production.
And it'll be repeated often.
It was no fooling. There were tears in my eyes at points.
It was that good.
Yeah, it is.
Yeah, I'm looking forward, but I have to put an evening aside.
Yeah.
And for those who don't know, Bryn Terfel, who is, you know, I've seen him as Votan. He's one of the great, great opera singers in history, not just living, in history. He's a baritone. People tend to celebrate tenors because of all the Italian opera written for tenors. But he's more Germanic, even though he's Welsh. If the name Bryn Terfel was like,
there wasn't a hint.
There's no vowels in there.
Yeah.
Okay, that's one thing. Emma Thompson?
Emma Thompson was good. I will say this. I thought we were talking about this last week in the car. You should take a recorder into the car, by the way.
I have one. I just don't use it.
Yeah. She was very good. I will say that. I will say... Angela Lansbury.
Angela Lansbury owns that role.
Yes, yes.
And always will.
Yeah.
Well, any production that will ever come, Lansbury owns Mrs. Lovett. And there are other good interpretations. This is, I would say, the second best interpretation that I have seen. But just the idea that Emma Thompson, people think Emma Thompson They think of her in that fictional movie about... why am I blanking on...
Was she in the one about the... oh, good Lord.
Saving Mr. Banks.
Yeah, okay. Yes, right, yes.
Which is a fictional movie in so many ways.
Yeah.
Walt Disney was never in London in his life, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And she was invited to the premiere and all this stuff, P.L. Travers.
Yeah.
And she was, and she had plenty of money. She just wanted more because she was a world traveler. Mm-hmm. She had, was raising a child. She was gay. I mean, come on. None of that's, you know, it's one of many fictional bios, such as Finding Neverland, in which by the woman dying of cancer and all that, and she was married at the time that she and J.M. Barrie were having an affair. And a tie-in between that and Saving Mr. Banks that they never make, and Emma Thompson, P.L. Travers' agent, Peter, who shows up early in the film and tells her that he has to make that deal, that is the Peter that J.M. Barrie was writing the stories after. He's Peter, the real life Peter Pan. And they never even mention that in Saving Mr. Banks. Anyhow, Finding Neverland, the musical, opens on Broadway in April.
Yeah.
Ugh.
Well, I can't afford it anyway, so, you know, it's. I'm not rushing out. That's not the one I'm going to be seeing. I've still got to try to see. Oh, good Lord! The one about the Wicked Witch. Wicked.
I've never seen Wicked.
Yeah.
I'm a big fan of Gregory Maguire's, and I think I'm probably doing him a service. No,
I would like to see Wicked. It's supposed to eventually be a film version, but given
why it hasn't been yet.
Well,
Disney
keeps trying to do different versions of Wicked. Frozen, I think, is actually meant to be Disney's Wicked.
No, it's the Snow Queen.
It's the Snow Queen. Yeah, well, they're taking the Snow Queen story and they say, okay, if we can't do Wicked, we'll do it with the Snow Queen.
Yeah, semi, but you know, it's not like Disney doesn't do things over and over again and change the story as much as they can.
Yeah.
But Wicked is already so different than the novel Wicked.
The Oscar-winning song Let It Go is Frozen's Defying Gravity.
Okay,
yeah.
That's fine. Who wrote Let It Go?
It was
because Stephen Schwartz, I mean, I loved Pippin. Especially the current production.
Yeah.
The current production, I saw it with the original cast, including Help Me, SCTV.
Andrea
Martin.
Andrea Martin, yes.
Let me tell you something. She's not in the cast anymore. Well, it's been running well over a year.
Yeah, that's true.
And these people get six-month contracts. And sometimes they'll sign up for another 6 months.
Yeah.
But, I mean, that cast, that production, directed by Diane Paulus, blows you away.
Yeah.
It's an incredible, incredible show. And I liked, and it out, I saw the original, directed by Bob Fosse. This one was more Fosse-esque. If you can believe that, right. Because they took his métier, they took his form, and they used it more than he did. And they turned Fosse from one focus thing into a three-ring circus with all three rings doing the Fosse stuff in the circus atmosphere. With Stephen Schwartz music.
Right.
But Wicked, Maguire, by the way, has a new novel coming out, and he'll be on this show again. And, or at least I assume, because in the past, and every time I've called his agent, he's been right here. And, although actually we record during the day because he has a long way to travel. He's in like upper Connecticut.
Mm.
It's Alice in Wonderland related.
Yeah.
He likes dark satire.
Mm-hmm.
And L. Frank Baum, oh, that's it. They're doing a movie of L. Frank Baum.
Oh, good.
I knew there was something important. So here we go. So we now have movies. Let's name the children's writer who have fictional biopics.
Mm-hmm.
C.S. Lewis, that was a play and then a movie in...
Yeah, I
what
don't...
What was the title?
Yeah, that one I don't remember. No.
Something
like that.
Yeah,
okay.
Only that story is actually pretty close to what really happened.
Yeah.
Neverland has, which bears very little resemblance to what J.M. Barrie was like or who he was. Saving Mr. Banks, pretty fictional.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, she had all the resistance to the film, but that's because Poppins is a dour, not nice character.
Wow. Yeah, that's true. That's true. But, you know, Disney doing a film about Disney making...
Well, that's
making
not,
Mary Poppins.
Except that wasn't what it was. It was an independent film company making this film.
Mm-hmm.
And they said to Disney, you've got first dibs, but if you're not taking it, we go to Universal. They had the rights from the P.L. Travers estate, and they didn't need Disney.
Mm-hmm.
And he's a historic figure, and there's nothing. They had Tom Hanks, they had Emma Thompson, and Disney could distribute it or not.
Mm-hmm.
The movie was going to be made. Now, whether or not Disney had a hand in the Disneyfication of the story of what Walt was like. I mean, they didn't paint him out to be an altogether nice guy.
Yeah, but they didn't. I'm sure there's here again. I haven't seen
there were
film,
there were dark aspects. I'm, well,
I wasn't racing out to go see that film. So,
taken as fiction, it's a good movie.
Mm-hmm.
Taken as fiction, it's a good movie, but that's what it is. So, who are the other children's writers who they're biopics of? There's the one which I still haven't seen, Renee Zellweger as Beatrix Potter.
Yes,
Miss Potter.
Yes, yes.
I haven't.
There was.
That's in my queue.
What was it? The film about the Reverend Mr. Dobson.
There's more than one.
Louis,
but the really good one by Dennis Potter.
I think we're thinking of the same one.
Yes. In Home.
With the Henson creatures.
Yes.
Yes, yeah.
And Ian Holm plays the Reverend.
Yes, yeah.
John, but that is fiction from the get-go.
It's
Dennis
fiction.
Potter had no interest in anything except the concept.
Yeah.
The popular concept of Charles Dodgson. Mm-hmm. And he does it so well.
Yeah.
I love Dennis Potter. We were talking off-air. And by the way, if anybody subscribes on their Roku box to a service called Acorn TV, do be sure to check out the 8-part... It's really two shows, 4 parts. The first one, Karaoke, and the second one, Cold Lazarus, starring Albert Finney and Francis de la Tour,
mm-hmm.
written by Dennis Potter. It's the last thing he wrote before he died. And there's also like a 1-hour special written within a month of his dying, and he knows that he's dying.
Yeah.
During the interview, I don't know if they have that on Acorn, but I remember it from PBS, he's constantly drinking. I'm sorry, what's a painkiller? It starts with an M.
Oh, that I don't know. I don't know.
The painkiller. It will kill you.
Yeah.
It's what they use for amputations.
Yeah.
I'm sorry?
Morphine?
Morphine,
yes. Okay.
He's drinking bottles of morphine during the interview. That was the state of his cancer.
That was the interview where he comes down hard on Rupert Murdoch, wasn't it?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. Absolutely. Yeah, he did not.
He had nothing to lose, and he talked like it.
He never had anything.
That's true, though.
He was always that way in his writing.
Yeah.
There are many dark Alices, but that one that he wrote, Black Alice by Thomas M. Dish, are among my favorites.
Good Lord. You know, I stumbled upon that decades ago. It's an obscure book. You know, I looked around because I'd finally like to read this. I doubt it's in print.
Oh, it's not in print. No way. Michael Swanwick posted on Facebook a couple of months ago. He said, I don't believe there's been any more adapted and drawn from story than Alice in Wonderland. And I think he's right.
I wouldn't argue with him on that.
You know, there are one or two TV versions a year.
There was one I saw. This
Christmas Carol, maybe.
This was late 80s, early 90s, about a woman whose sister got killed in a tenement building. And she moves into the tenement building. And essentially, it's a mystery story, but it actually takes the form of an adaptation of Alice in Wonderland.
Mm. That sounds interesting.
Yeah.
I don't know that one. When you, if you remember what it is, email me.
Was a real low budget film.
That's okay.
Yeah,
that's fine. A wonderful, bizarre low budget film that I liked was the most memorable thing, aside from the bizarre black and white 60s photography, the soundtrack by Ravi Shankar, Peter Sellers, Terry Thomas, Peter Cook, Dudley Moore, Judy Dench, etc. Somebody named Olivier. John Gielgud is the Mock Turtle. I mean, on and on and on. And it is one of the most psychedelic, trippiest, bizarre things.
I think I've seen that one.
And it's not Richard Lester, although it might as well be.
Yeah.
I think it's actually Jonathan Miller. Early Jonathan
Could
Miller.
Be.
Not that early, because Beyond the Fringe was the
50s. Yeah.
But And then Peter Sellers was in another one. There was a Danny Kaye one for UNICEF.
There was a Hanna-Barbera one.
Oh, God, was that bad.
Yeah, not good.
That almost rivals The Hobbit.
the
Rankin-Bass The Hobbit. Now I'm going to get letters again and emails again from people saying, I love that. Yes, I'm sure. And you're how old, dear? This could be a boy I'm talking to. When you saw it, you were 8. You know what?
Yeah.
It was wonderful. It was wonderful. An 8-year-old seeing The Hobbit as Rankin-Bass animated adventure with songs by Glenn Yarbrough. It was your introduction to Tolkien, and it's perfect. Now, as a Tolkien fan, let me tell you, it sucked. as opposed to the Peter Jackson big-budget film, it sucked. But anyway, no, it didn't suck. It just parts of it suck.
In defense of Rankin and Bass, they did the entire thing in one film.
Well,
one film.
It's 180 pages.
Yeah, I know. Bless their hearts. They told it all the way it should have been told.
Well, you know, I think help me. Del Toro was going to do that.
Well, yeah.
Here's a theory.
Okay, you tell me your theory. I think it's going to match with mine. Tell me your theory.
Okay. You know how Peter Jackson takes Lord of the Rings and, for example, the Council of Elrond, which I did a production of in 1973, and he takes the entire Council of Elrond, which is 90 minutes long, read aloud, 100 minutes long, and what he does is he dissembles it, and he puts the story in its chronological order so that we have no need for flashback.
Mm-hmm.
Instead of everybody meeting and everybody saying what they had done up to that point, Jackson tells it going along. Now, Del Toro was going to make 2 movies.
Right.
The first one being the story of The Hobbit, There and Back Again.
Right.
And then the second movie, based mostly on the Silmarillion, in which he was going to tell story that goes from the Necromancer and how he becomes Sauron. And that was to be the second movie. But they didn't tell us that that's exactly how it was breaking down. And, you know, he's waiting for Jackson. He's waiting. After like 3 years, he says, you know what? I've got a contract here that says if you don't direct Pacific Rim by this date, you owe us $80 million or something like, you know, and he had other projects to do. Yeah. So he left, and Jackson, after wasting his time on King Kong and the Lonely Bones and all that, when he should have been filming The Hobbit right after Lord of the Rings, so that Ian McKellen doesn't look 10 years older when he's supposed to be playing 100 years younger.
Well, I don't think Jackson wanted to be shoehorned into the Tolkien films. I think that was...
Then he shouldn't have bought the rights from Saul's Ents. You don't want to do it, don't do it. Very simple. But he owned the rights. He held on to the rights. Nobody else could shoot it. Nobody else could film it. And he was going to produce it no matter who the director was. So he took the project over from the director whom he had hired, Del Toro, who had written the screenplay, who still has screenplay credit. He rewrote the screenplay, and here is my theory part, because everything now is historic. The theory part is he took Del Toro's two movies, and he has interpolated them. The story with the orc who's chasing whatever, and Radagast with the rabbits. Radagast is never in The Hobbit, but and Jackson failed to put him in Lord of the Rings where he belonged.
Radagast the superfluous.
Radagast the Brown, he's a wonderful character.
I'm sure he's a wonderful character, but in the film
he's not superfluous in the Silmarillion.
Yeah, but he is in the film.
But wait a second. The film is called The Hobbit. It shouldn't be called that. It's The Hobbit and the Silmarillion combined.
Mm-hmm.
Because everything in there is actually Tolkien. The problem is it's not Tolkien that Tolkien ever wanted to publish.
Yeah.
Oh, excuse me, that J.R.R. Tolkien ever wanted to publish. Christopher Tolkien was hot on publishing
it. I'm sure. The way Dr. Seuss's family are just so happy with having his
Jim Carrey's.
Jim Carrey, yeah, occupied.
Although Horton Hears a Who was not bad.
No, I didn't see that.
That's an animated. So, yeah. It's animated.
Yeah,
it's
I know.
Really not bad.
The ones that I have seen, which are essentially... Actually, the only one that I've seen is The Lorax.
And that's the best of a bad lot.
Yeah.
But Horton Hears a Who is pretty good. But all that aside, the point is that what I believe happened is that Jackson did what Jackson does. He's taking all the elements of the original screenplay, which was supposed to be two unrelated movies, and he's stringing them together so that you have one non-stop confusing mess.
Yeah.
And that, if he had just taken Del Toro's screenplay for There and Back Again and made that as one 3.5-hour movie, I think he would have had a masterpiece.
Yeah. Yeah. I wouldn't argue with that, but Jackson, I mean, the evidence has been there from way before. Jackson does not know the meaning of the word economy.
Yeah, in any sense.
Yeah.
In any sense. And I admire his skill, but I don't admire his storytelling.
What was interesting was when Roger Ebert reviewed King Kong, he summed it up as best as I've heard anybody summed it up. He said, it's too much of a good thing.
Well said.
Yeah.
Well said. Because, I mean, Adrian Brody, Jack Black, Naomi Watts, they're great.
Yeah.
And Andy Serkis is always great.
Yeah. We don't need a dinosaur stampede.
Yeah. The only thing I didn't like Andy Serkis in was Little Dorrit. Replace the Frenchman, but Dickens couldn't write that character. He's an awful character, Rimbaud. But anyway,
The push is on, I think, this year, or at least it seems to be, to get Serkis a Best Actor.
Well, it's about freaking time, because he deserved it for the character, who nobody says his name correctly. Yeah. Now, I did not ask Tolkien this, and people, yes.
Oh, well, I'm talking this year about his portrayal of Caesar in Planet.
Which I've not yet seen.
All you need to see.
I'm waiting for it to come around on a smaller screen.
Yeah.
But the
you're talking.
I liked the first film, and he was very good in that.
Yeah.
But he's obviously in Lord of the Rings again.
Yeah.
Gollum.
Okay. What
they call him Gollum? That's not how you pronounce it.
Well, yeah.
He makes, to quote Tolkien, he makes a noise in his mouth that can best be described as G-O-L-L-U-M.
Yeah, yeah.
So you think of this aquatic, poor creature and who's always swallowing everything he can find. It's Gollum.
Yeah.
Gollum. That's his name. I mean, his name is Smeagol, but those who want to denigrate him by calling him Gollum, it's Gollum, because that's the noise that he makes. Now, I blew the chance to ask Tolkien. I did ask Tolkien about Gandalf, and that's a story that we don't have time for.
So I'm coming back next week? Is that what it is?
Next week is Tempest Bradford.
Oh.
And she's going to help me pitch. You're coming back probably in about 3 weeks.
Okay.
In about 2 or 3 weeks, and you're going to help me pitch.
Okay.
And we'll try to find a premium. Something that when people subscribe to WBAI, they get, I've got it, a thumb drive with collected reviews that you've done for Hour of the Wolf.
I would love to do that for you.
That would be a cool premium.
I would be very happy to do that
for you. Yeah, and if we can throw in, like, a preview to a movie or something like that, which we can talk to some publicists about.
Yeah, sure.
By the way, people, interesting movie opening this week, or at least previewing on Friday, and then I think opening shortly thereafter, is The Mind of Leonardo, a 3D movie, which actually sounds like worth seeing in 3D, starring Peter Capaldi.
The man who saved Doctor Who.
No! Matt Smith saved Doctor Who.
No.
So did David Tennant. So did Chris Eccleston.
Eccleston, yes.
Yeah. And David Tennant, half of his episodes are really good.
Yeah, David Tennant.
And Matt Smith, his first season is brilliant.
I'll have to go
back. The other two I can do without.
Yeah, yeah.
Season 5. What they call season 5, what I call season 36. Thank you all for listening. This has been Hour of the Wolf. My name is Jim Freund. Dan Persons will be back. We still did not get to the agenda that I set, and we're going to keep doing that agenda until one of these years we get around to it. And
we take the recorder into the car.
We either take the recorder into the car, or actually what we do is we start a thread on Facebook. Something like that. Yeah. At any rate, stay tuned for Burn Baby Burn Clapper with Lister coming your way over these airwaves very shortly. Thank you for listening. Thank you, Lister, for being here. Thank you, Dan Persons, for being here.
My pleasure.
People can go to cfqonline.com to get more of the reviews and other interviews and things like that.
Yes.
And everybody, be good to each other. Have a good morning.
And you're gonna have to keep on saying that. You're gonna have to say that I am a proletarian. I am.
Trying to reach my freedom of speech and expressing myself, torching the symbol of oppression. Let that be a lesson to those that want suppression of the truth. Put on hold, the bold lose control, so they force obedience. Have you pledge allegiance to a piece of cloth? That's off the way I see it. While I'm going off berserk, cause the system works to jerk my people, the people all around the pig clerk. Tell me I'm wrong, though. That's my right in this writing the Constitution. Yo, that's an illusion, huh? Suckers trying to change and rearrange. They say that I'm free, but they still have a strange way of showing it. But I'm blowing the cover. The red, white, the blue, but the black for the brother. And I'm the lover of this flag, like many others take the same turn. Like me, they yearn for the flag too. Wake up to the lies, the bitch, makeup, imperialistic swans that I grind into bacon bits. Call it fist, cause I ain't taking shit. I'm not a Nazi or a Cappy or a Farmy, but you want me in prison, cause I'm pissy attack. The flag, I ragging and snagging and dragging and rip it to shreds. Cause I'm too black, too strong, too red, too dread. And I'm dreaded, cause I make the pigs dribble when I burn a symbol. Yo, I'm quick and nimble like Jack, but I'm a black man attacking the flag. I keep my torch handy, I'm no Yankee Doodle Dandy, so just hand me a flag from the fastest and watch me burn that piece of to ashes. Cause the real meaning is what the message must learn. That's why the red, white, and blue must burn, baby, burn. Let's find the people who hate this shit. These are the places we'll hit.
Panama, talking about Peru, Azania, Brixton, Belfast, can't forget Korea, Beirut, can't forget Haiti, Iran, Puerto Rico, Colombia, Mexico. Talk about uptown Harlem, New York City, y'all. And Nicaragua, East and South Central LA, California, IA, Miami. Do or die, Bed-Stuy. Never ran, never will, Brownsville. Boogie down, South Bronx.
The flag, I'm only doing what you told me. You don't like it, so what? I'm not
strike a match to the American flag and burn. Wait.
do.